All right, good evening to everyone. L'chol ha'mazinim. We're sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilin Shmas Yonah ben Rabbi Leib. This is part 11 of our series, The Law and the Law, Miranda versus Arizona, and the Torah's view of confessions. We'll be hearing some later. So this is one of the most famous cases of the 20th century, not because it affects that many of us, I hope it doesn't, but because it's been popularized by the culture. Everyone with a television has heard the sentence said to a new arrest, you have the right to remain silent. If you give up the right to remain silent, anything you say can will be used against you in a court of law. You have an attorney to be present during questioning. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you, free of charge. I first heard this, I must have been, I don't know, a child, where there was a show in the 60s called Adam 12, and they really popularized the Miranda warnings. So that and related rights are known in the trade as the Miranda warnings, and that is the subject of this evening, the case of Miranda versus Arizona. Now, one should not think that it is done in every case, as my brother could verify, although if it becomes an issue that it's claimed it's done in every case. I remember in the Bronx, I was once told by a police officer that Miranda warnings are for the movies. They don't exist in the Bronx. But in a high-profile case, it certainly would be done. And most often today, if it's a big case and defendants are confessing, then they'll sign written waivers, and it'll be videotaped as well, both the waiver and the confession. So the waiver is clear. Now, there's a context here as well that we started discussing last week. Here you have, again, it's the early 60s. You have a liberal court, the Warren Court, constructing an entire edifice of criminal rights, limiting the ability of the police to thwart crime and capture criminals. So this was a seismic shift in American life. By now it's so accepted that we forget 50 years ago the primary goal of law enforcement and the political class was to protect society, not to protect the criminal. But as we noted last week, once the elites pronounce the criminal not guilty by reason of class or race or background or hardship, etc., then the police became the enemy, or at least the adversary, and that paved the way for the good times of the 60s and 70s and a few decades thereafter, when crime in America became rampant and the inner cities became almost unlivable and people by the millions fled to suburbia. It wasn't always like that. In the immoral words of Justice Cardozo, I think we quoted once already this year, should the criminal go free because the constable has blundered? Well, that was a rhetorical question, the answer to which became in the 1960s, yes, the criminal should go free. And criminal cases became, at the onset of trials, not so much a search for truth or justice or even guilt or innocence of the accused, but exercises in questioning police conduct in terms of a potential violation of the rights of the defendant. So no doubt it elevated the role of the attorney, and I tilled that soil myself for many years, but I am aware that it wasn't always like that in America, nor is it necessarily moral or prudent or sensible to let the criminal go free because the constable blundered. But nonetheless, every society has the right to make its choices. It's not an immoral choice it made, and this is the choice, this is the system that has been constructed in America. No doubt society did suffer inordinately until the backlash began in the 1990s, and even more so in the last decade. So what exactly happened in Miranda? Well, Miranda was another rung on the ladder that began with Gideon versus Wainwright in 1963. I think it was the first case we analyzed, the right to counsel. There the court ruled unanimously that every criminal defendant has a constitutional right to counsel and to one appointed for him if he is indigent. This was expanded the next year in 1964 in the case of Escobedo versus Illinois. Danny Escobedo was arrested in the murder of his brother-in-law. He declined to make a statement. He asked repeatedly for his lawyer to come and was denied. He was interrogated for a good 14 hours before implicating himself. Now, no one says any force was used, but he was just worn down. One cop reached out to him in Spanish, how he'd benefit from talking, how he and his wife could go home if he just put himself at the scene, even if he pinned the crime on a third person. Sure. Well, he did that, and he was arrested, and he was convicted of murder, and he appealed on grounds of a denial of the right to counsel. The Supreme Court in Escobedo ruled 5-4, again a 5-4 decision, that the right to counsel applies even to pre-indictment interrogations. As long as one is in police custody, in a coercive setting, the right to counsel pertains. Justice Arthur Goldberg wrote the decision in Escobedo. He would resign 2 years later to become LBJ's UN ambassador. Interestingly, Agavurcha, LBJ wanted a Jew in that position in the UN, thinking it would defuse the New York Times criticism of his Vietnam policies. Didn't quite work out that way. Wasn't a good decision for Goldberg either. But nonetheless, he wrote the decision here, and he rooted it in the Sixth Amendment, the Right to Counsel Amendment. The Sixth Amendment reads, in pertinent part, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury, to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with witnesses against him, to have compulsory process when he could subpoena witnesses to come testify for him, and, I quote, to have assistance of counsel for his defense. And those are the key six words. Assistance of counsel for his defense. Goldberg ruled that defense meant as soon as an action proceeded against the defendant, meaning an arrest. Now, that's not entirely clear from the Constitution, because it says in all criminal prosecutions, well, until he confesses, he's not being prosecuted. And defense means once you've been charged. Before confession, he has not been charged. Nonetheless, Goldberg ruled this was not mere questioning about an unsolved crime. I quote, petitioner had become the accused, and the purpose of the interrogation was to get him to confess his guilt despite his constitutional right not to do so. At the time of his arrest, and throughout the course of the interrogation, the police told petitioner that they had convincing evidence that he had fired the fatal shots. Without informing him of his absolute right to remain silent in the face of this accusation, the police urged him to make a statement. Goldberg said the right to counsel would be useless at trial if he had already incriminated himself before trial. Now, of course, this was a very common technique, I guess in some cases still used today. You have two people, co-perpetrators of a crime, they're put in separate rooms, and they're each told that your partner confessed and is getting a better deal, so you might as well, he already incriminated you. Of course, none of it happened, but such a line is designed to induce confessions. Of the dissenters in Escobedo, Justice Harlan wrote, I think the rule announced today is most ill-conceived, and that it seriously and unjustifiably fetters perfectly legitimate methods of criminal law enforcement. Indeed, very few cases end with confessions, except on television, because everything has to be resolved either 30 minutes or 60 minutes, although it does happen. It certainly makes it easier for the police to incarcerate the guilty if they can induce a confession. Come. We're assuming they're not beating confessions out of people. In fact, Justice White added here, this new American judge's rule, which is to be applied in both federal and state courts, is perhaps thought to be a necessary safeguard against the possibility of extorted confessions. To this extent, listen to what he wrote, because it's true. To this extent, it reflects a deep-seated distrust of law enforcement officers everywhere, unsupported by relevant data or current material based upon our own experience. Obviously, law enforcement officers can make mistakes and exceed their authority, as today's decision shows that even judges can do. But I have somewhat more faith than the court evidently has in the ability and desire of prosecutors and of the power of the appellate courts to discern and correct such violations of the law. By a 5-4 vote, the court had ruled that suspects have the right to counsel even before trials begin. In the end, Escobedo was released. His case was reversed. He rejoined his Mexican gang. He murdered someone else in 1983. He fled to Mexico, where he again ran afoul of the law, and apparently he's still in prison today, almost 50 years after his case, in Mexico. All this set the stage for Miranda. Ernesto Miranda, a native of Arizona, was a career criminal, literally from grade school. He had served time on a variety of occasions, and in March of 1963, his truck was identified by the brother of an 18-year-old girl who had been kidnapped and raped by Miranda. Miranda was identified, arrested, and told by the police that he was positively identified. He confessed. He was taken to the victim. He heard her voice, put her in a separate room. He heard her voice, and he said, "That's the girl." She heard his voice, and then she identified him by voice as the rapist. Miranda wrote down his confession in longhand, writing on top of each sheet that he's confessing voluntarily and in his own free will, with no coercion, threats, promises, etc. And indeed, there was no coercion, threats, or promises. He was not informed of his right to have an attorney present during questioning, as per Escobedo. At trial, his lawyer objected to the confession. He was overruled. Miranda was convicted and sentenced to 20 to 30 years in prison. The ACLU took up his appeal. Really one of the first major public cases in this sphere. Miranda's lawyers, though, based their appeal not only on Escobedo and the Sixth Amendment, but they added a defense that his confession violated Miranda's Fifth Amendment rights. Fifth Amendment reads in third in part, "No person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law." So the argument was that Miranda was a witness against himself. But was he really a witness against himself? He was not testifying. There was no, again, criminal case that was against him. And was he compelled? Compelled to be a witness. That's the language of the Fifth Amendment. Was he being compelled? No, he constantly wrote. There are no threats. There's no coercion. There are no promises. He's confessing voluntarily of his own free will. The state of Arizona argued that forcing the police to inform defendants that they have a constitutional right to remain silent would greatly impair law enforcement, as no person in his right mind would then talk to the police. Here again, in 1966, the court consolidated three other cases that raised the same issue, two state, one federal, and here again the decision was 5-4. Narrow decision, and in favor of Miranda. Chief Justice Earl Warren wrote the court's decision, stating that this case discusses the critical issue of the restraint society must observe consistent with the federal constitution in prosecuting individuals for crime, and the court ruled for Miranda under the Fifth Amendment, not just the Sixth, as per Escobedo. So Miranda greatly expanded Escobedo. It was no longer a matter of right to counsel, but rather it was construed as a defendant having a confession, being forced to be a witness against himself. I quote, "The prosecution may not use statements, whether exculpatory or inculpatory," meaning attempt to prove his innocence or attempt to prove his guilt, "even if they tend to prove his innocence, stemming from questioning initiated by law enforcement officers after a person has been taken into custody or otherwise deprived of his freedom of action in any significant way, unless it demonstrates the use of procedural safeguards effective to secure the Fifth Amendment's privilege against self-incrimination." Meaning if one is in custody, then unless he is advised that he has a right to remain silent and advised that he has the right to have an attorney present during questioning, and any statements will be considered to have been compelled and therefore inadmissible at trial. And Warren wrote, quote, "The atmosphere and environment of incommunicado interrogation as it exists today is inherently intimidating and works to undermine the privilege against self-incrimination. That privilege is the essential mainstay of our adversary system and guarantees to the individual the right to remain silent unless he chooses to speak in the unfettered exercise of his own will." So once a person has been deprived of his freedom in any significant significant way, meaning he's in police custody, even though not formally charged with arrest, he's still considered to be in custody, and these rights pertain. Even though Miranda wrote in his own handwriting that he was confessing voluntarily, he had not been advised of his right to counsel, and so his waiver was not informed. With this, the Warren Court gave birth to the Miranda warnings. I quote, "The person in custody must, prior to interrogation, be clearly informed that he has the right to remain silent, that anything he says will be used against him in court. He must clearly be informed that he has the right to consult with a lawyer and to have a lawyer present with him during interrogation, and that if he is indigent, a lawyer will be appointed to represent him." And there's more. If an individual indicates, prior to or during questioning, that he wishes to remain silent, the interrogation must cease. If he states that he wants an attorney, the questioning must cease until an attorney is present. Of course, we'll never allow him to talk. It would be malpractice if he did. Where an interrogation is conducted without the presence of an attorney and a statement is taken, a heavy burden rests on the government to demonstrate that the defendant knowingly and intelligently waived his right to counsel. And the defendant can waive his right and then at any moment change his mind and clam up. And the police have to respect that choice and cease their questioning. These rules apply both to incriminating statements, even exonerating statements. I was there but didn't do anything. All right? It's not admissible. Mere presence at the scene of a crime is not exculpatory. You're allowed to be at the scene of a crime. But even that statement is not admissible. Theoretically, if he places himself at the scene of the crime, then if another witness, then he can't claim he wasn't there. And then there may be another witness who says he did do something. So therefore, any statement made, even the most innocuous ones, will not be admissible. And the presence of lawyers, Warren wrote, would prevent coercion in interrogation. An express statement that the individual is willing to make a statement and does not want an attorney, followed closely by a statement, could constitute a waiver. But a valid waiver will not be presumed simply from the silence of the accused after warnings are given, or simply from the fact that a confession was, in fact, eventually obtained. Also, as later became clear, if a defendant blurted out when he was first confronted by the police some incriminating statement, most popular being, "You got me," such a statement is admissible because it came spontaneously. Or if a person walks into a police station and volunteers a confession, the police have no obligation to warn him that he should not confess. Interestingly, Warren asserted that none of this was an innovation in the law, which of course it was, even though it greatly transformed law enforcement and the ability of the police to solve crimes. At least at one stage in a criminal trial, it was the police that were actually on trial and not the defendant. They had to defend and explain their conduct. Warren even wrote, I quote, "Our decision is not intended to hamper the traditional function of police officers in investigating crime," end quote. But that was an obvious consequence. And Warren addressed the issue of whether society's need for interrogation outweighs the privilege, and he ruled that it did not. In essence, he said, our civilization deserves better and can survive even these expansions of criminal protections. And he was right, but barely. Decisions like this ultimately promoted a distrust of the police and greatly expanded the rights of citizens, which is a positive, but also made the Warren Court into the criminal's best friend, which was a negative. It's not far-fetched to speculate that the explosion of crime in the 1960s and 70s were at least partly attributable to the increased limits placed on law enforcement. Very interestingly, I had a good laugh out of this, in one companion case, the federal case, Westover versus United States, the Solicitor General was Thurgood Marshall, and he would join the court a year later, big liberal, but because he was Solicitor General, he was forced to argue against Miranda. I actually listened to it the other day, and it's enjoyable seeing him struggle, saying how bad it is, and I'll give him a quote in a moment. He was against it. Of course, when he was on the court, he was in favor of even greater criminal rights. In another companion case, the Gnera versus New York, Telford Taylor, who was a former prosecutor at Nuremberg and later my own constitutional law professor, he also argued against what would be the majority decision. Well, Warren got his majority, including Abe Fortas, the Jewish justice at the time. He replaced Goldberg. But the dissent foresaw the problems. The main dissent, interestingly enough, was written by Justice Tom Clark. Tom Clark would retire a year later when his son Ramsey Clark became Attorney General. Ramsey later turned out to be a real radical and a bit of a nut. And it was Clark who was replaced by Thurgood Marshall. Now, Marshall had argued that the defendant in his case never asked for anyone, never asked for a lawyer, so why should his confession not be admissible? Clark wrote that the court's opinion is a classic case of ipse dixit, meaning he himself said it. It is to say the court's assertions are based on their own assertions, because they say it has to be so without any factual basis as a foundation. The critical factor should be whether or not the confessions were coerced, forced, involuntary. And there's nothing in the record that would support that. And that's a very reasonable standard Clark and the minority held. The police cannot force confessions. Everyone agrees to that. But why should they be placed in the situation of having to protect the rights of the accused and impair their own investigation? I quote, such a strict constitutional specific inserted at the nerve center of crime detection may well kill the patient. Custodial interrogation has long been recognized as undoubtedly an essential tool in effective law enforcement. And it was. Prior to this decision, the court had a reasonable standard that depended upon a totality of circumstances evidencing an involuntary admission of guilt. If the defendant came to court claiming his confession was coerced and his face was battered and bloodied, so you could assume it was coercive. Let the state, Clark said, have to prove that a waiver was voluntary, but do not categorically exclude all statements made in the absence of specific warnings. Now, Justice Harlan wrote in his dissent that the court's decision represents poor constitutional law and entails harmful consequences for the country at large. The new rules do not defend against police brutality or coercion, but, I quote, ultimately to discourage any confession at all. The aim, in short, is toward voluntariness in a utopian sense, or to view it from a different angle, voluntariness with a vengeance, end quote. Now, obviously, unless every precinct is going to have a lawyer on staff, if an accused asks for a lawyer can't afford one, then one cannot be provided until the defendant is in court, in which case the opportunity for confession is gone. Does failure to apprise a criminal that he has the right to a lawyer amount to him being compelled to testify against himself, the language of the Fifth Amendment? Harlan held that it did not, as a voluntary confession, such as Miranda's, cannot in any event, by definition, be compulsory. The Fifth Amendment does not prohibit all types of pressure in order to induce a confession. The police can use pressure, deception, even false promises. And there's a difference between police interrogations and judicial proceedings, which seems to be the focus of the Fifth Amendment in all criminal cases. A confession free of compulsion, free from compulsion, should be admissible, but as Justice White wrote in dissent, the court seems to distrust all confessions and thereby undermines the security of the law-abiding citizens. Well, we always do this, so what happened to Miranda? All right, and just typical of the genre we're dealing with, Miranda, the case, entered the popular culture and enormously impacted police conduct. Miranda, the person himself, was eventually retried, and he was convicted again, just based on the eyewitness testimony that he was the rapist. He was again sentenced to 20 to 30 years, of which he served 6. He was paroled in 1972, and he began selling autographed Miranda warning cards. It was named after him. He's a celebrity. He was arrested a few times until he was stabbed to death in a bar fight in 1976. a great loss to the world. Whatever constitutional celebrity he became, he really remained what he was, a thug, a rapist, and a threat to civil society. But he was always, and he is to this day, a symbol. He's a symbol either of the court's excesses that undermine the safety of the innocent, or the value of American society of providing even its lowlives expanded and idealistic constitutional protections. So, what does the Torah have to say about all this? On the surface, the matter seems cut and dried, whereas the American Constitution has a privilege against self-incrimination, the Torah has a prohibition against self-incrimination. It's based on the principle of Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha. No person can make himself into a Rasha. It is based on Gemara Sanhedrin, Testament Beis, Omer of Yosef. Here are two cases. Ploni Ravo L'Onso. Man comes to court with another witness. Man comes to court with another witness and says, this person raped me homosexually. So he's a witness, another witness, fine. Ploni, let's say test comes to court, testifies, Ploni Ravo L'Ritzono. So-and-so had homosexual relations with me, and I agreed, consensual relations. So Gemara says, Rasha who? Such a person is a Rasha. You can't say this outside anymore today. V'atora Omra Al-Toshes Rasha Aid. Since he admits that he had consensual homosexual sex with another man, he's a Rasha. A Rasha's possible Avis. So his Avis is no good. Rava says differently. Adam, he can't testify because Adam Karav Eitzel Atzmo. Then Adam Mesim Atzmo Rasha. Man is considered related to himself. A relative is disqualified from testimony, so therefore no person's testimony about himself is believable. There's a difference between the two. We'll get to it in a moment. The point is, if he's raped, then he can testify with another. But if it's consensual, so then such a person is a Rasha and cannot testify because he's inherently disqualified as a witness. Rava argues that he cannot testify to any action that will render him defined as a Rasha because he's related to himself. Doesn't mean he can't testify against another. Rashi explains here, Rav Amar, Ein Adam Nifsal Le'edus Bodas Piv. Nobody can disqualify himself from being a witness because of an admission that he himself makes. The Adam Karav Eitzel Atzmo. Every person is related to himself. Hilkach, therefore, Ein Adam Yachol Lasum Atzmo Rasha. No person can make himself into an evildoer. Klomar Al Eidus Atzmo Ein Onase Rasha. On his own testimony, he can't be a Rasha. Shari Torah Pasla Karav Leidus. The Torah disqualified relatives from testifying. V'nerag Haroveya. Nonetheless, the other party is still killed. Why? De palginon dibura, because we split his words. Umehaminon le legabe chavre. He's believed vis-a-vis someone else. Velo mehaminon le legabe dide lifsoledus. But he's not believed regarding himself. In other words, according to the first opinion of the Gemara, Roshahu, Altashas Roshahei, in the consensual case, you don't have two good witnesses, because he himself is a Rasha, so the criminal is freed. But according to Rava, he's puzzled as a Korov to testify against himself. So he's not believed regarding the testimony about himself. The testimony about himself is rejected, and we split his words. We believe him about the other person, but we don't believe him about himself. Palginon divura, we divide his words, his testimony. The only way a person is construed as a Rasha is if two witnesses testify against him. Rambam says in Hilchos Eidos, Perek Yud Beis, Halacha Beis, Ein Adam Nifsal Ba'Avera Al Pi Atzmo. Nobody can disqualify himself through in sin through his own words. Ketzad, Haresha Bola Basin, V'Omar, a person comes to Basin and says, Shegona, V'Ogozal, O'Hildo Baribis, he says he stole, he robbed, he lent money on interest. Afa Pisha Mashal Piatzmo, Enonifso, even though he may have to pay, he's not Pasul Eidos. If he says he ate treif or he lives with a woman he's not allowed to, he's still not disqualified. Maybe he's boasting. Until the two witnesses testify against him. Now, one notion that drove this concept was people's reluctance to be witnesses. Let's say they want to testify in court. So if not for this principle, people will be able to evade their obligation to testify by admitting to some sin. They'd come to court and I can't be witness, I ate treif, and they'd be disqualified. So that option was taken away from them. A person is simply not believed when it comes to testimony affecting himself, and a person therefore cannot make himself posel le'edus. The Rambam gives another reason, Hilchos Sanhedrin, Perek Ches Halacha Vav, interesting reason. He cites a few cases of Kanon Pogimba where the Beis Din is really uninvolved and vigilantes can act on the part of the Tzibur. And the Rambam says, Gzeres HaKosov Hi Shein Nanisen Beis Din V'lo Malkin Esa'odim Ba'odas Piv Elo Alpi Shnayim Edim. It's a Gzeres HaKosov, it's just what the Torah wants, the decree of the Torah, that Beis Din will not execute nor give Malkos to any person based on his own confession only by testimony of two witnesses. We have two cases in the Novi that he mentions. We'll get back to one later. Ochon, the Battle of Ai, Ochon was the only Jew who took spoils in the wars of Canaan. It was a capital crime. Yeshua made him confess. So the lottery fell upon him. He confessed. He was killed. David killed the Ger HaMaleki, the Amalekite convert who came and said that at Shalomel's request, he helped him kill himself. Both cases, they confessed. Both cases, they were killed. How could it be? So the Rambam says, HaRasha HaYisa, it was an emergency. Oh, Din Malchus Hoya, it was the decree of the king at the time, which is extrajudicial, supersedes normal procedure. Aval Sanhedrin, Ein Mamisin V'lo Malkin Amoda Bavera, but the Sanhedrin will not execute or even flog one who admits a sin. Shema Nitra Fadaito B'dovarza, maybe the person a little crazy. Yeah, these people that show up at the police stations confess to all sorts of crimes for the publicity. Today you get a book deal out of it. Shema min ha'amelin moi nefeshu. Maybe he's one of those people despondent in spirit. Ha'mechakim lamavas. They want to die. Shetokin ha'choravos bevitlom. They stick daggers, stab themselves in the stomach with daggers. U'mashlichin atzmei agadot. They throw themselves off roofs. Shema kach ze yavo v'yom adavish lo also kedei sheyehoreg. So maybe this person will come and confess so he should be killed. We have today, it's common in New York, death, a suicide by police. People provoke a confrontation with the police, even hold a fake gun, so the police will shoot them. They don't want to kill themselves. They want the police to kill them. Klolo shel davar, gzeres melechi. Rambam says you can't accept confessions. Maybe the person who confessed is of such a despondent spirit. The klal is, it's a gzeres hamelech, gzeres hakosov. The Radvaz gives an interesting reason. The Radvaz, a gzeres hakosov, for which we can't give a reason, but if he could, he would say the following, and he did. We can give a small reason. Man's soul does not belong to himself. It belongs to God. Our lives belong to God. Says in Yecheskel. Hanashamalach, we say in the Tefillah. Hilkach, lo toil hoda'osu bedover sheina shalom. Umalko's Pagadamisahu. So his confession will never be valid in anything that affects his life, because his life is not his to give away. Malkos is half a death, he can't give his health away either. Alpha Mamona Hu Shalom, when it comes to monetary matters, as we'll see, in monetary matters and civil cases, admissions are admissible, they're valid, because the money belongs to him. Umishum Hakyam Rinon Hodas Baldin Kimea Adim Dame. If a litigant confesses or admits to a certain stipulation or admits to what he did, he's like 100 witnesses. I remember I sat on a case once, we heard 90 minutes the plaintiff made a compelling case, should have asked for an open sentence from the defendant first. His turn, defendant says, everything that is true, I owe him the money, I can't pay him. Now what?
All right? So had we known that 90 minutes before, it would have been a much simpler matter to resolve. But Hodas Baal Din, Kamei Eidim Dami. You don't need witnesses when a guy says, I did it. He's right. Just like a person has the right to commit suicide, so does a person the right to admit to something which will give him the death penalty. His soul, his life does not belong to him. Animode, the Rabbas continues, with all this I still concede, she exeris malko shel olam vein lahaher. This is God's decree, we can't question it. Interestingly, even though women are disqualified from Eidos, this principle of Ein Odom Mesim Atzmo Rasha applies to them as well. Based on the Ran in Perek HaMadrin Ksuvos of Ayin Beis, it discusses, let's say, a woman admits that she fed her husband untied foods, even ate it herself. So regarding what she did to him or her, it's not valid, but she could forfeit a ksuba as well. One other point in this regard, this ban on self-incrimination applies only to sins that deserves some punishment from Beis Din. But, as we noted, in monetary matters, a person's admissions prejudice his rights and are enforceable against him. That's how Das Baal Din, it's actionable. So although the woman is not believed that she ate untied food, if she serves it to her husband, she's penalized by potential loss of her forfeiture of a ksuba, that's money. So too, if she admits an affair, she's not believed regarding the affair and the status of her marriage remains the same, but she does lose her ksuba money. In Mamonis, we accept it. So there are consequences to a confession in the realm of Mamonis, but not in the realm of Isser. This is because, as the Radvaz said, the money is ours to give away. But just like we could take our money and throw it out the window, so we could take our money and throw it to another litigant or throw it to Beis Din. Therefore, it's ours, and if we want to give it away, we can. Additionally, there's another form of confession that is acceptable, even mandatory, and that's vidui tshuva, a confession for the purpose of repentance or to avoid an isser. So, for example, a kohen who kills another person is not allowed to duchen. But he's believed to the extent that he can't duchen, because to duchen would be a sin, even though we can't prosecute him on that basis. In a very fascinating case, the Chavos Yoyer, Rav Yoyer Bachrav, in the late 17th century, it's Siman Ayin Beis in his Tshuvos. You think, oh, we have problems today. No, it's always the same. A woman confessed to her husband on her deathbed that she had had an affair, and then she recovered. Does the husband have to divorce her? Because on a deathbed, we maintain a person never lies. It's derech tshuva. The Chavos Yoyer said, yes, she has to divorce. He has to divorce because we believe her. The confession is valid. Others disagreed because of ein other mesim atzmo rasha. It means before God. God decreed, Xeris Melech, that you never believed about what you say about yourself. Or the Sma quotes the Mordechai that it could be a Rama. Maybe it was another angle she was playing. You could concoct a scenario. She pretended to be on her deathbed. She was in fact on her regular bed, not her deathbed. And she was trying to work him somehow. And that's what she confessed. The clearest expression of Vidui Tshuva is a principle enunciated in the Mishnah and Sanhedrin in Perek Vav Mishnah Beis. When they were approaching the Beis HaSkila, they were executing a convict, when they were about 10 amos away, Omer Mlo, we would say to the, accused, the convicted, Hisvada, confess. Shekein derech hamumusin misvadin, the way of all people near death is that they confess. That's our source, by the way, for the Vida Shudnera. Shekola misvada yeshul chelek olam abba. Anyone who confesses has a share in the world to come. Shekein matzinu be'ochon, the case of Ochon, Yeshua said to him, confess? And he said, indeed, it was me. He said, chatasi, I sinned. Such a confession led to his death, but it brought about kapara for Achon, brings about kapara for the accused as well. Let him confess. V'im eini yodei l'svados, if he doesn't know how to confess, Omrim lo, we say to him, and more, you should say, Tehei misasi kapara al kol avonosai, let my death be a kapara for all my sins, and that's vidui tshuva. But again, that's not something that's actionable in court, but rather, it's for kapara, there's a spiritual benefit. Now that begs the question, so how did Achan confess, and why did Yeshua seek to induce a confession? So the Rambam says on the Mishnah that it was a harasha, either because it was an exigent circumstance, either because the goral was a lottery that identified Achan, but the Torah doesn't punish al pi goral, people will suspect it, or because it was necessary to show the people the justice of the system that he in fact was guilty. All of which engenders the next question. If it was necessary for Yehoshua to extract a confession from Achan, isn't it plausible that under the Torah system, confessions could be of value in apprehending Jewish criminals as well? We also don't want society to be afflicted by criminal behavior, and it would seem that the Torah unequivocally takes this weapon out of the hands of Jewish law enforcement and relies on two witnesses exclusively, right? Not exactly. And as we noted last week, there's the principle of Din Malchus, the Rambam quoted here as well. Din Malchus, the king's law, also known as the betterment of society that we're able to access. There are really two parallel tracks in Jewish law. There's the law in the books, and there's Din Malchus, where the king, the government, has the right to act for the betterment of society, even if they temporarily waive or supersede some aspect of criminal procedure. So we also believe in a presumption of innocence, and we also believe that no one can be punished without due process. But we have a greater priority. We do insist that society be protected, that innocent life be protected before guilty life. Thus, we have cases where confessions were coerced for the betterment of society. Achan is only one. There's a tshuva tashbeitz in Chelek Gimel Siman Kuf Samechei tashbeitz of Shimon ben Tzemach Duran. So, on basin of Algiers, after the Rivash died, he himself died in 1444. Here's this case: he had two people traveling. One was a blind Jew, and the other was another Jew, and they were traveling to sell precious stones. They're sharing a room in an inn. The stones of the blind Jew disappear overnight. The only suspect, the only possible thief, is the other person. Problem. The victim can't see. He's blind. So what are you going to do? Tashbeitz writes, Tshuva. Yaduahu ki agone vein agone be'edim. A ganav, by definition, is a burglar. Never steals with witnesses. If we required witnesses for such a stealthy theft, the attribute of justice will be afflicted. The harashus nesuna biyad kol dayan b'chol dor b'dor ligador b'dorim b'zeh. Permission is given to the courts in every generation to erect fences in cases such as this, like the Gaonim did b'dine knossos in case of fines. V'af mi dinat Talmud, even according to Talmudic law, mutalasos can is permissible. U'makin v'on shen shaloka din. You're allowed to beat someone, punish someone, even extrajudicially, misha migdor milsa, to set an example. The koshkein lahatzil oshuk miyad osho, v'ne'elav miyad olvo. So too to save the oppressed from the oppressor and the embarrassed from the one who's embarrassing him. We have a case in the Talmud, Kafte Va'ode, someone was tied up until he confessed. There's a story in Baba Basra, Baba Metzia rather. Daf Chavdala Ben Aleph, Mar Zutra had a silver vessel stolen from him. It was in an inn. The next day, he saw a yeshiva student, Barbe Rav, wash his hands and then dried him on someone else's jacket. Alright? Mar Zutra said, this student, hai hu delo ichpat le amamona de chavrei. You see, he has no respect for other people's property. Kafte v'ode. They tied him up, and he confessed to stealing Mar Zutra's vessel as well. So the Tashbatz concludes, v'chein kos v'sefer hachoshim v'shem tshuvas harosh. case in Russia's time. Uqvar osarti ani beveis hasor yehudi mikan ton olav orach nufusi shagonav mamish. He incarcerated a Jew who was accused of theft. Va'al yedei nikar and divrei emes, because the complaint seems so credible, asartiv, I tied him up, incarcerated him, locked him up. V'lohaya sar moshe shepatru, and none of the local magistrates or officers would free him. V'chakach nimseis hageneva biyodo, later on the stolen object was found in his property. V'kilsuni kol hakohol, and everybody praised me, al zriz v'sibozeh, my assiduousness in this case. So you see, you have such cases. Or Mechaber says in Chashan Mishpat in Simon Membez, "Vimtsarech lochov lebalashar ulhakoso kadesha yode yaser kadesha yotzi adim amito." You can force an owner of a document to accede to its authenticity, but that might be momentous. It might be a little different. But even in criminal cases, the procedure is standard and favorable to the occasional criminal, but it will never be allowed to paralyze law enforcement and terrorize good people. Even the Chofetz Chaim writes, it's in Hilchos Lashon Hara, in Siman Zayin, Halacha Yigimel, Basin has the right, when circumstances demand, harashah, when it looks like a criminal will escape, and the innocent will suffer, even to beat a person until he confesses. We can beat people if we think they're guilty, to make him confess. Otherwise, society crumbles. So, Basin has to weigh the seriousness of the crime, the credibility of the evidence against the accused, the danger to society if he's not dealt with, the amount of force necessary to extract a sincere confession. There are many things to weigh. We don't even have to speculate how a Jewish court would deal with a ticking time bomb. You know, the apprehended terrorist who has information about a pending terrorist attack. The Bush administration euphemism, coerced or enhanced interrogation techniques, will be child's play, because the rights of the good people come first, and they come second as well. Of course, you can't always beat a confession out of someone, because then people will always confess, even falsely, just to stop the beating. It has to be measured and reasonable and driven by necessity. Well, just to sum up, Miranda was a revolution in the approach to crime and greatly aided the criminal in escaping prosecution or conviction. After Miranda, only a complete moron would ever say anything to the police, because it can and will be used against you in a court of law. Every intelligent person knows never to talk to the police, because no good will come out of it. People think they'll talk the police out of arresting them. Usually they talk the police into arresting them. Interestingly, just a few years after Miranda, Congress passed a law effectively nullifying Miranda as not constitutionally required in federal cases, and Congress by law tried to make the standard exclusively one of voluntariness, not formal warnings. The court ruled that unconstitutional, Dickerson versus United States in 2000, ruling 7-2, Scalia and Thomas dissenting, that Miranda warnings are a constitutional obligation. But as a result of the eruption of crime since Miranda, the court's been walking back the cat and been limiting the effects of the decision. For example, permitting the admission of spontaneous confessions, permitting confessions that were made after waivers that were made knowingly and voluntarily, even if the suspect was later found to be insane, and making a public safety exception. If there is a ticking time bomb, you don't have to give a person his rights, and you could use whatever information he gives against him. And in 2010, in Burgess versus Tompkins, the court ruled 5-4 that a waiver of rights need not be explicit. Interesting case. Tompkins was read his rights. He was interrogated for 3 hours, and he sat completely silent. He never said anything. He just sat there staring ahead. After 3 hours, one of the cops started talking to him on a spiritual level. Be good for the soul, get off your chest, etc. He opened up and confessed. The mere fact, the court held, that he was silent for so long was not an indication that he was asserting his Miranda rights. Here he never said he was waiving his rights, nor did he say he was asserting his rights. He said nothing. If that's the case, when he started to talk, his confession was admissible. This discussion and the balance between defendants' rights and society's needs will go on indefinitely. The Torah's general standard, barring any confession, is even more extreme, but is subjected to extra judicial limitation if the times and the case and the potential harm to others all require it. I thank you all for your kind attention. We resume this series now after Pesach with some very exciting cases, so please come back. Chag Kosher Sameach.